Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Sports and politics and sports and politics and sports and politics and
intersection.
Arrogance and ignorance, arrogance, ignorance, and arrogance and ignorance.
Intersection.
Top of the morning, we have to kick off sports and politics this week because not arrogance and ignorance this time around.
No.
Not at least with respect to the principal of the story. That would be Scottie Scheffler, your now two-time Masters champion. But some of what surrounds Scottie Scheffler after he made this statement, you know, prior to the kickoff of this weekend's Master.
And as far as her going into labor, I wouldn't say I'm very concerned. We haven't seen any of the, you know, early signs, but pregnancy is weird. It can happen anytime. But yeah, open lines of communication, and she can get a hold of me if she needs to. And yeah, I'm ready to go at a moment's notice.
Yeah, I'm ready to go at a moment's notice.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. What a lovely man. Ready to go at a moment's notice. He would have skipped the last few holes at the Masters, Dan, had she gone into labor.
No, he wouldn't have. But the question is, you know, at any point, because this became a storyline all weekend, that if Meredith Scheffler went into labor, then Scottie was going to exit stage left, even though he was in the lead for most of the last 3 days, certainly the last two. And I mean, really, yeah. who would leave the Masters for your wife going into labor? Because what is the point of you being there? There's nothing you can do.
Well, no. But
what you can do, there's nothing you can do in terms of delivering the baby. What you can do is win the Masters and a $2 million check and all the endorsement deals that are attendant to that, which will just be amplified because he's right. Already got most of them. That's what you can do. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Is there any wife that would really expect her husband in that situation to leave mid-tournament and sit around the waiting room for a kid pop out?
It's more than that, Dan. They don't sit in the waiting room anymore. That's in the 60s and the 70s. Now they're in there breathing with the wife, holding her hand, wiping the sweat off her brow, seeing things that they don't want to see, smelling things that they don't want to smell.
Oh, my God. Oh, yeah, that really makes it more attractive. The wiping sweat, that's what the nurses are for.
Okay. No, I mean, you honestly think he wouldn't have left if he was, you know, say on the, approaching the 18th green and she went into labor?
The 18th green, I mean, that would be irrelevant at that point. It's irrelevant the last day because of how much time, I mean, do I have to tell you this, how much prep time it goes into actually delivering the kid?
Well, everyone's different. Some, their water breaks and they deliver in the car on the way to the hospital.
Coming up the 18th fairway with a 4-shot lead, let's not be ridiculous. I'm saying he's in the lead going into the final day, and she goes into labor. He's tied for the lead going into Saturday, and she goes into labor. Does he leave? Do you expect him to leave?
Yeah, I mean, if he was a man of his word and said, you know, golf will be here forever, witnessing he's already won the Masters. It's not as if he hasn't had donned the green jacket, but seeing his son be born for the first time, yeah, I think he would have left. I really do.
What should he have done? What should the wife have done is the question.
Okay, what the wife should have done is traveled with her OBGYN to Georgia, near, and she gave birth, and he could go and watch and
then
come back.
Why can't with that, why all the trouble? Her doctor is in Dallas, and so be where your doctors are and where you're comfortable. Why she doesn't need to travel with him, and he doesn't need to go back. You do your business, and you get here as soon as you can after you win the Masters.
My dad wasn't there when I was born. He was on a business trip, I think, in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And he stayed for the business trip.
Exactly.
No, he couldn't get back. What was the story? Dad, if you're listening, you could call in 312-642-5600. Well, he was out of town.
I'll tell you, I don't know your cell phones back then. I don't know your dad well, but I know just from his love of golf that if Harvey Jacobson was in contention of the Masters, that he would not be leaving Augusta to come back to welcome Amy into this world. And I don't think any less of him. In fact, I think more of him for it.
Well, back then, two men weren't in the delivery room.
Why do they have to be in the delivery room now? We're getting a little far afield, but why do you have to be in the delivery room now? What are you doing there? Moral support?
Yeah, they just want to be a part of it. I don't know. It's
no,
weird.
They don't.
No, and no, I they had don't. My kid ripped out from my sunroof. That's what we call it. Jaime was there. He didn't faint, but it was not pretty.
This was supposed to be sports and politics, not gore and politics.
You guys don't know how bloody it is. I mean, it is tearing and ripping and screaming. And
Club Pro guy, the great Club Pro guy, started a thread yesterday. In addition to the obvious question of who would actually leave and what wife would expect their husband to leave in that context of being in contention for the Masters, of which guys wouldn't leave, and then you have this rundown of offerings of both professional golfers and just generally athletes that are not exactly renowned for being good husbands, particularly OJ since he was just in the news. Populating the thread that was started by Club Pro guy. But I just the whole thing. I mean, Scheffler is by all accounts, like a truly committed Christian and a very good guy. And he's got a great marriage and that's all wonderful. But there is no way anyone in contention for the Masters leaves for the birth of a child. You can have more children. You know that. You don't know if you're going to get any more green jackets.
Maybe this
is also why Dan Proft is single. I don't know, but I'm just saying.
It could be. I don't know. Has any other athletes left during a game? Well, in baseball, it happens.
This isn't a game, and this is not one of 162 games where you leave in the fifth inning because your wife goes into labor. This is the Masters. I don't know how to communicate this in any more strident fashion.
But he was when even it's asked about his wife after the round, he was so sweet. Ladies love this guy.
What a time in your life. How do you put this into words? You win the Masters. You're about to be a father for the first time. It's pretty sweet.
Yeah, you're about to make me cry here in Butler Cabin. No, it's a very, very special time for both of us. I can't put into words what it means to win this tournament again. I really can't put it into words what it's going to be like to be a father for the first time. So looking forward to getting home and celebrating with Meredith. And it's been a long week here without her. But I'm just looking forward to getting home.
Yeah, he hits all the right notes. I miss her. It's been a long week without her. I mean, this is a man you want to marry, ladies.
Yeah,
he's
taken, so you're going to have to settle for the rest of us. You missed it. Tough. Scheffler, again, I mean, who doesn't root for Scottie Scheffler? And not just because he's just a great golfer and he's fun to watch, but because he is, generally seems to be a decent guy who's hyper-focused and he's got all his priorities aligned appropriately.
Yeah, I mean, I believe that today's plans were already laid out, many years ago, and I could do nothing to mess up those plans. I've been given a gift of this talent, and I use it for God's glory. That's pretty much it. So when I'm out there, I try to compete to the best of my abilities. Like I said, I really want to win. I feel like that's how I was designed. I've been that way since I was a young kid. That's always been a part of me, and I don't think that should be going away anytime soon. And I don't believe there's anything wrong with that either. But at the end of the day, like I said, my identity's secure already. And I get to come out here and compete, have fun, enjoy it. And then at the end of the day, win or lose, my identity is secure.
Kyle.
Yeah, how much do you...
The best text message.
Yeah.
Dan and Amy, she should have had birth or given birth on the 18th green in front of everybody. Okay. Dan, when you say the wife should do your business, like it's just doing a number two in the bathroom.
Kevin Rooney tweeting, if Scheffler's wife is anything like mine, she'll have labor induced just to test him. And if he doesn't show, she'll name his son Tiger. Yeah,
another one. 9 months ago, they could have used a condom or birth control a few weeks sooner or later.
Well, it's a little hard to predict on the nose, you know, Sunday at the Masters. I mean, you know, 9 months, but it's give or take a little bit, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, okay. Yeah, I mean, I don't actually know of any family scenario. I was talking to a friend about this when we were watching the Masters, and I was saying, like, I can't imagine a family scenario, any family scenario, in which it would be okay to leave the Masters. For example, this is what I suggested. Mm-hmm. Your wife is taken hostage. It's a hostage situation, and you have to leave the Masters or your wife gets killed.
Oh, my God.
Right?
And then you'd consider leaving the Masters?
No, I wouldn't. But there's nothing you can do about in that situation. And
but
also,
you don't negotiate with hostages. Is that what you're
you don't negotiate? Right? You don't negotiate with terrorists. Uh-huh. Exactly. Then the terrorists win.
Uh-huh.
That'd be anti-American.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So even in that scenario, I cannot imagine a scenario in which, I mean, could try to come up with one. Maybe you think the going into labor is one, but I literally could not come up with a scenario where I could say that makes sense, that it would be justified.
I mean, personally, if it was my husband, I would say stay and make money for the family.
Okay, right.
We could FaceTime or we could record it, but, you know, I don't know. It's their first child.
They're 27. They're going to, you know, you got to get plenty of time for more kids.
Oh, dear Lord, look who's on the line. Oh, no.
Dennis and Crystal Lake. No. He's been in the delivery room.
Hey, Dan and Amy. I didn't get to see my first boy born because I was deployed.
Restraining order? Oh, no. Mm-hmm.
Deployed. Well, restraining order later. But anyways, the warden, she wanted me in that room 24/7. It was an 18-hour labor. I couldn't get a babysitter. I got my 7-year-old boy there. And then I had never seen a delivery. And then, you know, after 18 hours of whining, the warden all of a sudden goes into labor. And then I see the thing shoot out. It was the afterbirth, and it slid.
Oh, boy.
I thought it was the baby. I go, I guess I would have left the man. I'd leave Chuck E. Cheese to go there.
Thanks for the call, Dennis. I wonder if Scotty Scheffler refers to Meredith as the warden.
Probably not.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So, I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630. And learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
America First with Sebastian Gorka. Weekday afternoons at 3 on AM 560. The Answer.
All right, Dan, getting a lot of text messages about that last segment of, you know, would you leave the Masters to watch the birth of your first child?
Or even my scenario, your wife is being held hostage and the terrorists are saying you have to double bogey 18. Well, it wouldn't have mattered at that time. You have to quintuple bogey 18 or the wife gets it. What would you do?
Yeah, what would you do, Dan? Yeah. So we got a text message from our favorite engineer. My wife was in labor and I was taking construction pictures. Of course you were. And then went home and watched TV.
Yeah.
Wasn't there? Yeah. Men back then.
I'll meet you back at home with the kid.
Uh-huh. And our own Quinn here, Quinn McCarthy, guess where he was born? His mom, she went into labor. She didn't even make it to a hospital. He became into this world in a janitor's closet at Illinois Masonic Hospital.
Wait, he was at the hospital.
But they couldn't make it to labor and delivery, and she was breaching, so they just went to the first available room, and it was a janitor's closet.
Wow.
And now we have baby Quinn. Isn't that crazy? So, yeah. Labor can take days, hours, but it could also be in seconds.
And was his dad in the janitor's closet having to endure all this?
Yes, he was.
No, he wasn't.
Yeah, he was. Quinn.
He was in the janitor's
closet?
His dad
was with the mom.
Well, with her, but I mean, you sit outside and you have a cigar.
No, you don't light it up outside the hospital anymore. Mm. Yeah.
All right. I mean, I just thought the whole thing, I think Scheffler was just making a genuine comment about the excitement about being a dad. And if his wife goes into labor, he'll be there at a moment's notice. You know, a moment is ill-defined, though. A moment could be, a couple days, depending on where I am in the Masters at the time. Anyway, I'm glad he won. I'm glad we didn't have to see that any sort of scene that would have forever damaged sports.
Stop it.
By someone in the lead for the Masters actually leaving to go sit around waiting for his wife to give birth. Okay, we have to turn our attention to the latest developments. Generally speaking, with violence in America's urban centers. I know, homicides are on the way down in the first quarter of 2024, and the people in charge know what they're doing and it's working. I got it. I got the official story. Okay. So anyway, back to reality. Dexter Reed, the individual that was shot and killed after he opened fire on police, that traffic stop that we were talking about all last week when the body cam footage from those five officers and the tactical unit that were involved was released. So now there are suits being filed on behalf of Dexter Reed, so that his family can get a payday. Is that too cynical? I don't think so.
No.
The Tribune looked at some of the court filings, finally making themselves useful. Somebody over there. Reed repeatedly sought legal remedies for his financial, medical, and psychological struggles after he was wounded in another shooting in August of 2021. This Reed's representations in those filings. I'm physically disabled and mentally unstable with PTSD, short-term memory loss, slurred speech, dropped foot in one of my legs, blindness in one eye, shoulder arm hard to move, weakness and or sensitivity. Court filings that he, these are representations and court filings he made last year. With all these medical conditions, it's been hard for me to work and or do certain things.
Oh.
Uh-huh.
Is he trying to get on Social Security disability?
Well, he filed multiple lawsuits against multiple individuals, none of which went anywhere. I'll get to that, but
wait a second. August of 2023. I was shot in August of 2020.
As we reported here exclusively, he got a $20,000 PPP loan during COVID for a quote-unquote transportation business.
And I reached out to ask his attorney what transportation business, what did he do, and I've not heard back.
I bet you haven't. Uh-huh. But his attorney, Andrew Stroth, Dexter sustained a serious injury from a family altercation in August of 2021. This was the shooting. He was a competitive basketball player and an athlete, but here we go, his entire life. And after that incident, he spent several months recuperating and rehabilitating from that major injury. The injury was traumatic. It was really traumatic for him. There were no criminal charges, nothing legal. He just got in an altercation. He was shot, and he never fully recovered. And over the past couple of years, the family shared with me, he's been working to recover both physically and mentally. golly, I would like to know a little bit more detail about the shooting, the little family altercation. That was no big deal. No criminal charges were filed or anything.
He just lost vision in one eye.
But he was shot, and he's got all these debilitating injuries. And what was the exact circumstances of that shooting? Why were criminal charges not filed? Was he the victim or the assailant and somebody was defending himself? There was a lot of legitimate questions, I think, surrounding that shooting that speak to this young man who is an athlete and basketball player and all that business all his life.
And I heard that after that incident, that that's why he lost his basketball scholarship. Which, I don't know.
That doesn't make any sense.
Well, no, that he was so injured that he couldn't play basketball.
The timing of it doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't.
He's 26 years old. That was 3 years ago. This is, but basketball scholarship to where? Morton College, where he played basketball? You don't get basketball scholarships to JUCO. What are you talking about? There's no basketball scholarship.
I listened to V103 Chicago Talks yesterday
V103.
When I was driving, and people were calling in. And one of his friends said, yeah, that because that happened. He said it was a family member shooting. He had PTSD because of it, and then he lost his basketball scholarship. He couldn't play basketball anymore.
Yeah, okay. Well, we don't just repeat things people make up. Okay. I mean.
Well, no, a lot of people's scholarships got extended because of COVID. There's still people that have.
He was at Morton College. Yeah. He was out of Westinghouse in what, 2018?
Yeah.
Come on.
All right.
But how about this family shooting? Hey, if there's a shooting among family members in your family, is that a big deal or no? For me, it would be a relatively big deal, I think.
I don't know why weren't police called? They just took him straight to the
hospital? No, it was a criminal. There's nothing criminal here.
Oh,
it's just somebody shot somebody.
Oh, a mutual combatant, Stan? Is that what we're working with here?
Yeah, they were right. They were doing a reprisal of Hamilton. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Yeah, he's filed suits against the city's finance department, against a former college basketball teammate who did a GoFundMe page for him. And he never gave him any of the money, allegedly, and his former employer, Monterey Security. Wait a second. I thought he was an entrepreneur and he got $20,000 of taxpayer funds for a transportation business. Sure. OK, never mind. Those were all filed in March of last year. Not that long ago.
Monterey Security.
Those are all dismissed. They went nowhere. Uh-huh. Hmm. So. I mean, I guess I'll have to be the one to ask the question because nobody else in this city will. Derek Reed and his family, are they victims of the system? Or are they gamers of the system? Now, I'm sorry he's dead, but it was at his own hands, effectively. Are they victims of the system? Or are they gamers of the system? I'm getting a little weary of having to pretend that people like Derek Reed, and until I hear more details about this family altercation that led to his shooting, that led to him being shot, that they are gamers of the system. And it's sort of important that you are able to distinguish who's on which side of that ledger. Victims versus gamers who are presenting as victims, because they get paid out, and they will in this case for sure, because the city is just set up to be a racial spoil system. I mean, the mass shooting that Mike Scott's been reporting on in Back of the Yards, where that 11-year-old kid was murdered.
No, 9-year-old girl.
9-year-old girl was murdered.
And here's her father.
At first, I thought it was fireworks, man, but when I saw my daughter laying down on the floor with a bullet in the head, I realized it wasn't the fireworks. I tried helping her, but it was too late. She had passed away.
Uh-huh.
9-year-old girl dead. 1-year-old still in critical. 3-year-old boy still in critical. And 8-year-old.
1, 8, and 9.
So
3 boys. 1, 8, 9.
Gang-related.
Well, that's what the cops said.
Yeah. So this harkens back to something that Terry Hillard said years ago. I'll just never forget. He said, if you have a family member who is a gangbanger, don't invite them over to your house. Don't go to their house. Don't go to events with them. Because if there's retaliation, you'll be caught in the crossfire. And isn't that the truth?
I don't think prepubescent kids have much choice in the matter.
No, but they're adults.
Who their parents are.
Yeah.
So I go back again. So now the grieving father. If Chicago police are right that this is gang related, what am I supposed to how am I supposed to understand this Mr. Molino? How do you want me to understand that? How should we process that?
Well, I don't know if he was the gangbanger. The whole family was there, so I don't know who the gangbanger was.
Uh-huh. So how do you want me to process that? I mean, not that the city really... I mean, this will dissipate into the ether like all of these mass shootings in the next 24 to 36 hours. So really it doesn't matter that much. There's not any processing really going on in Chicago. Generally speaking, with the majority of the residents in Chicago, they don't process anything. They just feel, oh, isn't that terrible? Oh, it's so sad. And then they move on. There's no thinking. There's no processing. There's no making any of determinations, because that would implicate some sort of responsibility to behave differently, at least to think differently. And that's just a bridge too far. I get it. You know, there's that Atticus Finch line from To Kill a Mockingbird, where he talks about the individual versus the mob. See, the mob doesn't have a conscience, but individuals do. And the line is, you know, individual joins the mob when he wants to take a break from his conscience. Well, that's what Chicago is. Mob. When we say mob mentality, that's what I'm talking about. Nobody has to take any responsibility because the mob moves in unison. Oh, that's so bad. That's too bad. So sad. Oh, that's an outrage. Oh, that's a good person. Oh, that's a bad person. Nobody has to take any ownership of anything. They just feel as a mob and move from feeling to feeling, where they reinforce one another as being good people. Good people that are feeling the right things at the moment. All right, now let's move on to our next feeling. That's what will happen here with this Dexter Reed business, with this mass shooting in Back of the Yards. You think they want to process the majority of the electorate in Chicago? They want to think about Dexter Reed's family? You think they're asking the same questions about that family altercation in which Dexter Reed was shot, but police were not involved because it was, you know, just a shooting among family members? Do you think anybody wants to process what sort of culture exists where the lawyer representing the family sloughs off that sort of altercation involving a shooting the way that he did and wants to completely disconnect it from his conduct since? And I'm not just talking about on March 21st. I'm talking about the retail theft charge last year. And I'm talking about the illegal use of a weapon charge last year. I'm talking about the kind of life Dexter Reed was living. While we're supposed to, oh, that's too bad, so sad, feel for his family when they take their turns at the microphone with their plaintiff's attorneys saying they don't understand why cops, quote unquote, murdered their baby boy.
Nobody wants to talk about the possibly fraudulent PPP loan that he took out for a transportation business.
Nobody wants to talk about any of it.
Because it doesn't fit their narrative. It doesn't make him look good. We got a text message saying the Hoop scholarship reference is part of the calculus of his missed future NBA earnings for a city settlement.
Yeah, right. Right.
Put it past him. Yeah.
There was a cop murdered in Memphis over the weekend. See if this story rings familiar. Something else that the identitarian mob in Chicago will, if they hear about it, oh, that's terrible.
I feel so bad. We need our police. They'll say, you know, all the appropriate phrases you say at a wine and cheese event in Wilmette. Memphis Police Chief C.J. Davis, C.J. Davis is her name, gives us the update on Friday after the dust settled and one police officer was dead, one suspect was dead, two police officers were injured.
A total of three officers were struck by gunfire. Tragically, one of our officers lost his life. That officer is Joseph McKinney. He was assigned to the Rain Station Alpha Shift. The second officer was brought here to Regional 1, but thankfully, he has been upgraded to non-critical condition and he's doing well. The third officer was treated on the scene and is in stable condition. One suspect was 18 years old, and the other suspect is 17 years old. Both suspects were transported to Regional 1 in critical condition. Both of them sustained gunfire as well. One suspect has been pronounced deceased. The 18-year-old suspect was arrested in March 2024 by MPD in a stolen vehicle with an illegal modified semi-automatic weapon with a Glock switch attached. The Glock switch converted the weapon to a fully automatic machine gun. He was also charged at that time for two stolen vehicles and having a programming device commonly used to steal cars. The suspect was released at that time without bond.
Right. Mm-hmm. The suspect, the 18-year-old who was shot and killed by police in that shootout in which one police officer was killed and two were injured, had all that artillery that you heard the police chief describe in March of this year. And he walked ROR. And now when police, Memphis police, walk up on what they thought was a suspicious vehicle, they receive a hail of bullets that takes the life of one officer from this guy that was ROR'd back in March. The DA in Memphis, Stephen Mulroy, he ended cash bail because it marginalizes people of color. Soros gave him $300,000. That's his campaign. Those are prosecutors all over the country, including our very own Kim Fox. And those are the results. But don't think about it, Chicago, the majority of Chicagoans. Just feel your way around with the mob, so that you don't have to process any of this.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today, 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I want to continue on police for just a second because I want to connect it to some other goings-on among the base of the new Marxist Party. because you're about to hear some comments that I'm sure some Democrats would repudiate, just like they would repudiate the anti-Semitism of an AOC or an Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, all the socialist Spice Girls. But I'm sorry, when you throw in with that party, and that is the feature of the party, the identitarian vitriol is the feature of that new Marxist party that used to be called the Democrats. How much of it is a feature? You can repudiate the death to Israel, death to America rap all you want, and then watch the president that you supported in 2020 and probably will again alter American foreign policy in the direction of Hamas and its sponsors like Iran to appease a domestic political audience. And you tell me they're not connected. That's not who we really are. Okay. Okay, Highland Park. Okay, Glencoe. You tell yourself that. Go ahead and lie to yourself. I mean, you lie to yourself about all sorts of other topics. You might as well continue it. That's fine. It's your right as an American to lie to yourself. And nobody does it better than Chicagoland residents. But if you don't mind, we'll just go ahead and point it out and present the evidentiary case for those that may be persuadable. Abby Phillip, CNN, interviewing Cornel West's VP candidate, his running mate. All this fanfare with Nicole Shanahan, RFK Jr.'s running mate. What about Malina Abdullah? A lot less fanfare. I mean, I know Cornel West is going to barely register a blip when it comes to actual votes. But hey, if CNN and the cable news networks care enough to platform him, as they have for so many decades, because, you know, he's an Ivy League academic, then why not dig into his running mate? Well, I guess to her credit, Abby Phillip on CNN did. Malina Abdullah is the former head of Pan-African Studies at California State University. She is also the co-founder of Black Lives Matter LA chapter.
Oh.
And here's her views on police.
You have tweeted in the past about supporting defund the police, which is something that I think perhaps some people in the Black Lives Matter movement support, but also this tweet from back in 2015. The KKK, the police, and government officials are one in the same. I wonder, do you stand by that comment?
Absolutely, and thank you for having me. Want us to understand the history of policing in this country. And so Twitter doesn't allow you to give a whole history of policing in this country, but in a few sentences, we can just confirm that there is no historian that I've ever come in contact with who disputes the fact that policing in this country hails from slave catching. And so when we say that policing is, you know, the new millennial slave catching, we're not saying that we don't want public safety. We're saying we want real public safety where community is really centered, where Black safety is centered. And we know that when Black people are safe, we also create safety for everyone else.
Right. KKK, cops, same thing. Policing emanates from slave catching, and it persists on that shore to this very day. Thank you. Wow. I appreciate the candor, Ms. Abdullah, vice presidential running mate of Cornel West, career academic. But that's not even what most Black Americans think, Dan. I know. So why are you affiliated with a party that would platform? Well, she's an independent candidate. Really? Was Black Lives Matter LA? Was that an independent movement? Did that have any party affiliation? Defund the police? Where was that coming from? The same new Marxists that represent the center of gravity and the new Marxist Party, which used to be called the Democrat Party, but it doesn't deserve that name anymore. Oh, they don't believe it. No, they don't believe it, but they fall in line and they elevate people in the academy like Malina Abdullah. You know, all the institutions they control. It's not just about public office. It's also about a cultural direction. It's also about the justice system, the people that have been underwritten into prosecutors' offices. We just talked about one, another one in Memphis, another Soros prosecutor. Let a guy go that had what they would otherwise call weapons of war, but he walked ROR, and then he was involved in a cop killing over the weekend in Memphis. Let him go ROR 2 months ago. Not even. Month and a half ago. But there's no dots to be connected here. There's no responsibility to be distributed. That's the one thing the left won't redistribute, responsibility. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. So the individuals like Miss Muhammad, I mean, you see them out on the streets right now. You think that the defund the police apparatchiks that were attacking people at restaurants, shutting down expressways, doing all the things that you're seeing now from the alleged pro-Palestinian protesters, really pro-Hamas protesters, Hamas sympathizers. It's the same people. It's the same philosophy. It's the same maturity. It's the same party. I'll give you an example. She's been attending meetings, village board meetings in Bakersfield, California, long before October 7th and the response to it. Gosh, I wonder what she was talking about before then. I think I just told you. Her name is Riti Patel. And she represents what I think is the quintessential pro-Hamas, defund police, Black Lives Matter, Democrat political operative in 2024 America, in that new Marxist party.
Hi there, my name is Riti Patel. I'm here to speak in support of the City Council introducing a ceasefire resolution, specifically the one United Liberation Front has drafted. I don't have faith that you'll do this. You guys are all horrible human beings, and Jesus probably would have killed you himself. And the thing is, though, it's very clear to me as someone who's been an organizer for the past couple of years that none of you care, because you guys don't care about anything happening in Palestine or any other country where oppression occurs, because you don't care about the oppression occurring here. And I understand that you guys are all horrible people, but the thing is, 2,300 people being evicted in the last year, those are votes. And you guys, those are votes to win here in Bakersfield. And while you guys parade Gandhi around as a Hindu holiday called Chaitra Navratri starts off this week, I remind you that these holidays that we practice, that other people in the global south practice, believe in violent revolution against their oppressors. And I hope one day somebody brings the guillotine and kills all of you motherfuckers. The increased criminalization for no need other than you don't like when people come and hold you guys accountable for introducing ceasefire resolutions, because the only escalation in violence has been by you all. And so there's no need to continue. In the last 5 years I've attended city council meetings, there's never been metal detectors. There's never been more cops. The only reason you're doing it is because people actually don't care if you guys don't like them, and they're actually resisting. So you want to criminalize them. So regardless of whether you elect people into office, they'll backstab you, they'll let you die, and for that reason, you guys want to criminalize us with metal detectors. We'll see you at your house. We'll murder you.
Next speaker, please.
Mike.
Lance, followed by Kev, followed by Valeria. Ms. Patel, that was a threat. What you said at the end, and so the officers are going to escort you out and take care of that.
Arrest her. Throw her in the jail.
She's been arrested. She's been charged with 16 felonies, making terroristic threats. She's on a $1 million. She's got a $1 million bond, and out when she got arraigned, out came the waterworks. It's a tough talk. Then came the waterworks because she's a maladjusted, snotty, ignorant, vitriolic, spiteful, disgraceful child. And that's who the left has given over to. Pick an issue, any issue, and you'll see Reedy Patels all over the place. Well, you think she's the only one? Pro-Hamas protesters taking over a Starbucks in Ann Arbor. Oh, that they didn't stop at the Starbucks in Ann Arbor. Then they went over to Springfest and shut that down and announcing a day of striking and whatever the hell in Ann Arbor on the campus of the University of Michigan, of course. As you can hear, there's a protest going on right now. Tomorrow, we are shutting down this university with an all-campus strike. The national strike was called by the Strike for Gaza Coalition. 23-plus Palestinian and Muslim-led organizations in support of Palestinian liberation. The data lines with tax data call it the use of...
I mean, yeah. You see the video, too. This poor girl's, you know, in a nice white spring dress playing the guitar, singing, and they just jump up on stage, take the microphone.
Yeah. Well, who's platformed them? We defer to them. Finally, the city council in Bakersfield had had enough, 5 years apparently, of listening to Reedy Patel making thinly veiled threats, and then she couldn't control herself and made a more formal one. Now she's being prosecuted, but you defer to these mobs, and then you, isn't it terrible they're taking over the Starbucks, they're taking over Springfest, they're shutting down the campus, they're shutting down Lakeshore Drive, they're bothering me in my workplace, they're bothering me outside of my kids' recital, they're bothering me when I take the family out to see a show. Well, you don't want to do anything, and you still don't. And they do. They're motivated. The motivated versus the unmotivated. Always a bad matchup for the unmotivated.
And just wait till the DNC. I mean, they had a gathering over the weekend where they said, you know, the march on the Democratic National Convention is going to be the largest mobilization of Palestinians in the country.
Oh, well, first of all, it's not Palestinians. It's not just.
No, it's more than white chicks.
This group is indistinguishable from what you saw representing Black Lives Matter, from what you see representing Antifa, from what you see with pea hats on running around the mall after Trump was elected. Indistinguishable. You think that these are siloed groups? They represent different interests? Solidarity and marginality. We've only been talking about it for the better part of a decade. That's the play. The oppressed throwing off the chains of their oppressors. That's their rap. And by the way, speaking of the DNC piece of it,
yeah,
they're in training right now, actually.
They are. Yep.
A 300 activists crowding the basement of Teamsters Union headquarters over the weekend here in Chicago.
Right.
To hear organizers from all over the country describe their plans to disrupt the DNC. We also have CTU making their offices available. Of course they are. Because you got to train people up.
Yeah.
You got to train people up for the revolution.
And just in case there's a snitch in the room secretly recording them, I think everyone's wearing their COVID masks because in this video, everyone has one on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that has nothing to do with snitching. That has to do with brainwashing. Shabir Rizvi, he's a member of the Anti-War Committee of Chicago. He's was there to instruct the apparatchiks in attendance how to say death to Israel and death to America in Farsi. Well, not say it, you know, shriek it.
Yeah.
Shriek it, because that's what they do, shriek everywhere they go.
So I'm going to teach you a chant in Persian that you can use if you ever encounter those Zionist freaks, whether they be Iranian or whatever, all right? Now, I don't drink margaritas, but we all know what a margarita is. We all know what a bar is.
And all these white.
So you're going to say, Marg Bar.
Marg Bar.
Marg Bar Israel.
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 Thank you.
What does that mean?
Oh, so it has two meanings, depending on the gender. It can mean death to or down with. So
can we get a Marg Bar America?
We can get a Marg Bar America.
Why don't you leave the country?
Marg Bar America!
Marg Bar America!
Marg Bar America!
Marg Bar America!
Thank you.
It's fun when a bunch of grad students with their loans forgiven get together to chant death to America and death to Israel, isn't it?
I mean, these are people are sick. And then some look like grandparents, but yeah, a lot of it look like they're just graduated. And whoever yelled, let's death to America, then get out of the country if you hate it here so badly. If you want it to die. Because he's part of it. And I can't, these people, I hope they know who they are.
No. They're not leaving. You're leaving. Or you're going to get rolled over. You're joining or you're getting rolled over. And if you want to leave, then you leave. They're not going anywhere.
Got a text message. Dan and Amy, this is shameful and outrageous. As a Chicagoan, I'm totally embarrassed that this hate-filled conference happened here.
What are you talking about? The rough and tumble Teamsters. They're supporting it. You know, the good men and women of the Teamsters. Our truck drivers and the people that are the backbone of our economy. And to a large extent, I agree with that. And then that's what you're a part of. Are you listening to this, Teamsters? All the tough guys? All the tough guys. And your headquarters are used
for that crap.
For this group. Are these the people with you whom you associate? To a Teamster, you'll hear the answer no. And to my response is, yes, they are.
My church absolutely, will probably
they are.
Let him in
absolutely,
next.
They are.
Yeah.
And you're also paying for it with your dues. That's who you're in bed with. Now you go ahead and go lie to yourself and say you're not. Just like Highland Park and Glencoe will lie to yourself, say that's not the party I'm a part of. Go ahead. Go ahead and lie to yourselves. That's what we expect you to do. And that's what they expect you to do. Even more importantly, Rick in Glenview, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, great show as always. Thanks.
Thank you.
First of all, I find that, you know, to figure out judges and prosecutors' records, like, for instance, how often they let somebody out and they commit a crime immediately, you can't trace that back easily. And secondly, I think the United States of America and our representatives, our stance should be that Hamas, since it's a terrorist organization, should unconditionally surrender, and we should help the people over there by getting them a decent government.
Yeah, okay. I'm bored with both. The point you're about reporting on judges and prosecutors, yeah, we need to do a better job of it. I'm part of some media group that's efforting in that direction to do a better job of inventorying the records of judges, of prosecutors, of keeping sort of a running archive of the one-off stories like the Memphis story we just talked about. The Dexter Reed story,
yeah.
As well, so that there is more institutional knowledge, because you're right. It's not as accessible as it needs to be. And of course, that's by design. Brian, St. John, Indiana.
Hey, good morning. I know a little 20-some lefty that won't use her Starbucks gift card anymore because they support Israel or whatnot. I don't pay attention to that stuff usually, but this kind of just brings everything back to your original point. It doesn't matter what stance you take with the mob, you'll never be right, and they will eventually knock on your door too. That's all I got.
Thanks for the call, Brian. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So Trump and his legal team tried earnestly to push off this Michael Cohen trial in Manhattan that starts today. Jury selection begins today. So it is moving forward, and in all likelihood will be adjudicated long before the November 5th election.
Yeah, he's going to have to be in court 4 days a week for the foreseeable future. They said the next 2 or 3 months.
So the question is, I mean, not can he get a fair trial. It's more like, is there any chance that you'll have one or two jurors that, even if they don't like Trump, they just can't abide this miscarriage of justice and will hold out and precipitate a mistrial, at which point any retrial would happen after the election. That's a possibility. Probably more likely that it gets convicted of something, given the jury pool and the judge, the conflicted judge and the conflicted prosecutor and this whole kangaroo court. The whole damn thing is out of order, to borrow from Al Pacino and Justice for All. That's the more likelihood, but it's possible. It's possible there's, you know, one or two or three stout Americans that won't participate in this legal charade, that have some respect for the justice system, more so than many of the stakeholders in Manhattan. So should Trump testify? Well, we've had this question before. When should Trump speak and when should he not speak?
Right.
How about in his own defense? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. He's itching to testify. Of course he is.
But it's always...
You plan to testify in your trial in New York?
Yeah, I would testify, absolutely. It's a scam. It's a scam. That's not a trial. That's not a trial. That's a scam. If you read Jonathan Turley, if you read Andy McCarthy, if you read the legal, they said there's not even a case there. That's election interference by the Biden administration. They actually took their top guy, one of their top guys, put him into the DA's office to run it, and it's a shame. What they have done is incredible. It's election interference, and it's got to stop. It's a third world country. This country's never done it. But you read Jonathan Turley, you read Andrew McCarthy, you read the legal scholars, every single one of them said that whole thing is a scam. It's not even a crime. And what they're doing...
Well, yeah, that is what Jonathan Turley has said. In fact, he said it again yesterday on Maria Bartiromo's show about how absurd this whole proceeding is. Jonathan Turley, George Washington University law professor.
Yeah, everything about this case is, in my view, legally absurd. You know, this case is basically a state misdemeanor that had run out on the statute of limitations. And Bragg was forced, after he declined for a long time to bring this charge, to do so. His predecessor rejected it. And so they took a dead misdemeanor and bootstrapped it into effectively trying a federal crime. But the federal crime here under election law was rejected by the Department of Justice. They didn't feel that this should be charged. So you have this crazy case that's going to go forward, and it's going to turn on the testimony of people like Michael Cohen. And Michael Cohen just recently had a judge call him a serial perjurer.
Wow.
And he's going to appear as the center of this case.
Our star witness, the serial perjurer. You know, pay no attention to his prior pathological lying. He's
a clown. I mean, this is just like the land of misfit toys here.
The other thing that's interesting about this is sort of the parallel with the civil case in which Letitia James is attempting and is being aided and abetted by New York courts to dismantle Trump's family business. See if you can catch the parallel. Let me give you a hint, or let Maria Bartiromo give you a hint.
This is from Stormy Daniels that President Trump posted. I know you've seen this. It says, Stormy Daniels writes, the fact of the matter is that each party to this alleged affair denied its existence. In 2006, 2011, 2016, 2017, and now again in 2018, I'm not denying this affair because I was paid hush money. I'm denying the affair because it never happened, writes Stormy Daniels.
I mean, and Trump said the same thing. I mean, the affair never happened. And I can't see, knowing what we know about him, he's so anal retentive, he's not going to, I don't sleep with a porn star. Ugh.
Well, the idea that Trump is above sleeping with a porn star, at least in a previous life, I'm not so sure I'm going to sign on to that statement.
Okay, well, I just...
What's the parallel? What's the parallel here? Based on the alleged victim's own words. The parallel between this and the civil trial, Stormy Daniels is in the position of the banks. There's no victim.
Right.
In her own words, I was not victimized. In the bank's own words, with respect to the assessment, the appraisal of properties, that we got paid back. There's no victim here. There's no victim with the business issue. There's no victim here, according to the alleged victims. And yet the prosecution persists, one civil, one criminal.
But back to your question, I mean, should Trump take the stand? I mean, Stormy Daniels is going to take the stand, Mitch. I mean, this is just going to be such a circus, this thing.
Well, but Stormy Daniels is going to take the stand. Right. So, I mean, it's going to be Michael Cohen Redux. Were you lying then or are you lying now?
Right. Then we'll find out, you know, what her story is now. But for the accused to take the witness stand is always risky, whether it's a president or, you know, your next door neighbor. It's always, they always say they're going to take the stand to testify in their own defense, but... If I was Trump, I would not just let them make their mistakes. And
I don't know about that. I don't know about in this case. You know, normally, I mean, I get the pitfalls with Trump because he's not exactly the most disciplined communicator we've ever run across.
No.
I got a text from 847 from a lawyer friend. I mean, who's like a very good lawyer. Not like Michael Cohen, like he's a real lawyer.
Okay.
Of course he shouldn't. They will ask him all sorts of questions like, did you ever cheat on your wife, et cetera. No way.
That's true.
I think that did you ever cheat on your wife, that's sort of past post. I think everybody knows. I mean, between Ivana and Marla and Melania and – I mean, I think – I mean, do you think that that is dispositive of anything for Trump?
Yeah, but
and his political, electoral, or even legal challenges.
But for him to say it out loud on the witness stand, that Biden's campaign can use that against him, take that, and I mean,
use it against him. How?
I know it's so passe. I mean, we've already litigated.
You think
this.
People care about that?
I don't, but maybe some undecided suburban women voters might.
I doubt it.
Really?
I doubt it very much.
It's just uncomfortable. I don't want to.
It may be uncomfortable.
It
may be uncomfortable. But the question is the cost benefit analysis. It's not whether there's some uncomfortable or risky aspects. There's uncomfortable and risky aspects to both testifying and not testifying.
But the jury's not going to matter to the jurors because they'll have their mind made up anyway.
Well, we don't know that. We don't know. You can presume based on the jury pool. You can. You know, handicap it. I agree that he's decidedly the underdog. That's obvious, but you don't know. And one of the things is, in terms of him testifying and whether or not some of his testimony would be objected to and be stricken, you can't unhear what somebody says, especially a former president of the United States. And there's an opportunity there for him to, you know, have a little bit of a law and order courtroom drama you know, potentially communicate to the jury about you may not like me moment. But if you care about the justice system, understand what you would be party to if you throw in with these people that have suspended the rule of law, that have made a mockery, frankly, of the principles undergirding a free society, starting with due process. In order to get a political opponent. You've all watched it play out. You've all heard from constitutional scholars and legal experts and so forth, including many people who don't like me and many people who won't be voting for me. And just understand something. If you're a party to this, you're going to essentially do more damage to America than you're ever going to do to Trump. Some moment like that may be of particular value in this case because... You know, I don't want to be a proponent of jury nullification, but this isn't a fair trial. And I think that whether it's, I mean, his legal representatives could do it, but there's nobody better positioned to deliver some facsimile of that message than the Trump himself. So that's why I would be pretty open-minded to the prospect of the former president testifying in a way that normally, particularly a witness like him, I would agree with the professional lawyers. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Corey in Woodlawn, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning. And how do we fight this type of tyranny? We can't beat him at the box. We got thousands of mail-in ballots from Zuckerberg. How do we fight these guys? That's the thing I'm so frustrated about. We can get out, we can vote all day long, but these guys, I mean, they're all over the place. Thank you.
Yeah.
And one thing.
Thanks for the call, Corey.
What I heard in church, like, well, he'll just pardon himself. I go, no, you don't understand. The president has no authority to pardon state crimes. So he can get anywhere for, if he's convicted, to, you know, probation to 1 to 2 to 4 years on each count in state prison. And that would be the ultimate interfering with elections.
Well, first of all, for anybody who's, even if it was a federal, if the federal issues, the J6 or the classified docs case, you say, oh, he could just pardon himself. What kind of statement is that? So do you say, do you think, first of all, that's assuming he wins the election.
Right.
But secondly, so you don't think he's guilty, but he can just pardon himself even if he's wrongly convicted? I mean, when somebody says he could just pardon themselves, what are they trying to communicate? It's no big deal if he gets wrongly convicted?
Yeah. I do. I think it's their way of processing it, like the lefty way of...
Their way of defending something that is indefensible.
Because they know, everybody knows, these are trumped up charges, that everybody knows they changed the laws in some cases just to go after him.
Well, yeah, you
such
just
a
heard,
witch hunt, my God.
You just heard Jonathan Turley go through chapter and verse on this case in Manhattan specifically, where this is, you know, Bragg's second bite at the apple and all the other federal prosecutors who declined and so forth. I mean, it couldn't be any more obvious. Lewis, Southside.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. Donald Trump, he says he understands. He said that when he was at the convention for Black Republicans, he said this. He said, they are treating me like they treat you. What he was referring to is that the only thing they want to do is get him in the system. And they have done that with Letitia James. They got him in the system. Now they want to do it with Alvin Bragg, get him in the system. And then they want to do it with Fannie Willis, get him in the system. If he just, Donald Trump has no political correctness. He's raw. He's going to speak what he said. The judge had already warned him, don't say anything. If you say anything, we're going to get you for contempt of court. If he just shut up and just sit down and let his lawyers talk, all this will go away because they have no basis. All this is falling apart because it's just like the people, Turley and all them said, it has no basis.
Thanks for the call, Lewis. Yeah, it doesn't have any basis, but yet here we are. So if you're Trump or just an outside observer, do you trust the system to produce the right result, even though we're this far along where the system has not produced the right result? So how can you trust that somehow this poisonous tree will bear edible fruit at the end? John in Palatine.
Hey, Dan. Good morning, and Amy, too. Listen, I have a question. If Dan, per your solid argument, if Turley and the legal scholars are saying that there's no merit to this case and the Justice Department would not even take it up, then how then can legally it even proceed? Can't the law profession, in terms of being lawyers and judges, see that there's no merit here and end it in and of itself? It seems like malfeasance to proceed.
Thanks for the call, John. Well, right, but you have a process. And in that process, you have prosecutorial discretion, which Alvin Bragg exercises, and prosecutors have wide berth on that. And you have motions to dismiss, to change venue, to force the judge to recuse himself, and those were all denied. So that's the process. Is the judge conflicted? Should he recuse himself? Yes, he is. Yes, he should. He's chosen not to. The grounds for appeal? Sure they are. Does Trump have, regardless of outcome now, does Trump have, well, obviously he wouldn't appeal an acquittal, but does this give Trump grounds for appeal, great grounds for appeal on a conviction? Sure it does, but that's after conviction, and that's really what they want. They don't care if it's overturned on appeal because they're not interested in justice. They're interested in providing messaging ammunition for the Democrats. Convicted felon, convicted felon, convicted felon, convicted felon. We get to say that for as long as that conviction, if it one were to be obtained in Manhattan, stands. So we have processes, but, you know, they're processes set up by imperfect men. And now you have processes set up by imperfect men being manipulated by malign men and women in the interest of politics, not justice. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. With respect to the Iranian attack of Israel over the weekend, it's a lot here. We have to go back to at least 2020 because this was part of the debate during the presidential race. And if you don't recall, now you will. This is what the big guy said at the time of Trump, the incumbent.
The world has changed because what Trump has done. And the American people, including independents and some Republicans, know how bad he is, know how much he's misrepresented, know how he's getting close to getting us in a war. I said, as the walls close in on this man, I'm worried he's going to get us to war in Iran. Unfortunately, I may have been right. The fact of the matter is there's a lot at stake in this election.
Right. He's the one who's going to get us into a war with Iran. And here we are. The Monday after a weekend effort by Iran to attack Israel and further destabilize the Middle East when under Trump we were having signing sessions, PR fets, where Israel was signing accords with Arab majority nations, the Abraham Accords, for sort of mutual peace, cooperation, and coexistence. So that was 2020. And then for the last year and a half, depending on the exact vagaries of things in the Middle East, we were getting this rap from the big guy, from animatronic Anthony Blinken, and from Lloyd Austin.
Don't. I have one word. Don't.
To any actor, state or non-state, trying to take advantage of this crisis to attack Israel. Don't.
We have just one word. Don't.
Yeah.
So effective. I'm scared, Dan. I'm shaking in my boots.
A vaudeville act.
Tola was too.
No one in Tehran was shaking in their boots, clearly. Mm. And they weren't impressed with Jake from State Department, who is a diplomat in the same way that Jake from State Farm is an insurance salesman, when he said this in September of last year.
The Iranian attacks against U.S. forces have stopped. Our presence in Iraq is stable. I emphasize for now because all of that can change. And the Middle East region is quieter today than it has been in two decades.
He was right about one thing. That can change, certainly, once the implications of your policies start to be realized. It did change. Things are stable in Iraq. It's funny. That's one of the territories from which Iran launched their strikes over the weekend. 300 drones and missiles from its own territory, as well as Iraq, Lebanon, and Yemen. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the run-up to this weekend. Now, what happened this weekend? Well, here is the retired general and former head of Central Command, Frank McKenzie, describing what I just said the Iranians attempted to do with their attack and how that attack was repelled.
I think this was a big attack by Iran. I think this was as close to a maximum effort as they could generate, and I'll illustrate it in this way. Iran has over 3,000 missiles of various types scattered around the country. They have about 100, probably a little more than that, missiles largely in western Iran that can target Israel. Based on what the Israelis are saying, I believe they fired most of those weapons at Israel. The Israelis obviously were able to intercept most of them. Iran could not replicate last night's attack tonight if they had to. Now, they also use cruise missiles and they use drones to try to present a multidimensional problem to the Israelis. It was a maximum effort. Now, the Iranians are going to backtrack and talk about moderation. There was nothing moderate about this attack, and I think John Kirby nailed it precisely when he was talking to you earlier about the nature and scope of the Iranian attack. It was indiscriminate, and it was designed to cause casualties, so we should just consider that as we take a look at it. Now, has deterrence been reset? I think the Israelis performed magnificently with our assistance and the assistance of other nations in the region, including the United Kingdom. And so I think that now the Iranians have to sit back and consider what they considered their most important capability. Their ballistic missiles, their drones, and their cruise missiles have now been employed in a major combat test, and frankly, that test has failed. So I think Israel this morning is now much stronger than they were yesterday, and Iran is relatively weaker than it was yesterday.
That stands to reason. So then the question becomes, why would the big guy, apparently on a call to Bibi, say, do not retaliate, take the win? If Iran is weaker, don't you want to go after your opponent when he is in a weakened state?
Yeah, urging Israel to exercise restraint.
Yeah, well, that's what they do. That's what they keep saying. Restraint. Restraint in the face of evil.
Biden had to come back early from the beach in Delaware, too. Sit in the Situation Room.
Animatronic Anthony Blinken said the following, unironically, on Meet the Press about Iran and their resources.
What do you say about the argument that money is fungible? So Iran may have known this money is coming and used other funds to help fund this attack that happened.
Iran has unfortunately always used and focused its funds on supporting terrorism, on supporting groups like Hamas. And it's done that when there have been sanctions. It's done that when there haven't been sanctions. And it's always prioritized that.
If it's always prioritized that, the obvious question is then why would we give them a red nickel? So why has this administration not only transferred billions of dollars, unfrozen billions of dollars in Iranian assets that go to fund terrorism, in your own words, but then also enriched Iran through our energy policies, the same way we have Putin, because you know, we're so busy transforming our economy into one powered by windmills and solar panels that the rest of the world is buying oil from our enemies and natural gas. Germany just teamed up with Russia.
Oh, great.
Oh, well, the ding battery that constitutes the hosts of these Sunday talk shows don't ask such impertinent questions. So we don't know what animatronic Anthony would say to that. Just walked right into the buzzsaw. Iran always uses every dollar they have to fund terrorism. And thus, why are we financing Iran, directly and indirectly? The sky that was lit up over the weekend, we're financing both sides of it. Why don't we pick a side? John Kirby, the aforesaid, you heard from General McKenzie, he got it exactly right. Well, he may have that the outcome exactly right. But this next piece, John Kirby was on with Jen.
Let it cook, Dan.
Facky. Over this concern. You know, immediately it turned to the concern of Israel's retaliation against the lead state sponsor of terrorism in the world. Because we don't want the region to go up like a Roman candle. Well, What scenario would precipitate that? Why would Iran think it can do the things it's done? Financing October 7th, retaliating for the Israeli strike on its embassy in Damascus. Why would they think that?
What can they do if Prime Minister Netanyahu just says, I know you said take the win, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do additional action.
Well, obviously, that would have to be his call. He's the elected Prime Minister of Israel, so he'll have to make those decisions in concert with the war cabinet. What we need to do, and what we will continue to do, the president will do, is make sure we've got the resources in the region to continue to defend Israel, as we did last night and as we have done since the 7th of October, but also make sure, and we get caught up a lot, and it's easy to, you know, about the troops in Iraq and Syria and the threats from the proxies, and those are real threats. But we also have broader regional concerns there in the Middle East, broader national security interests. And the president is keenly focused on making sure that the Iranians and everybody else knows we take those interests seriously as well, and we'll do what we have to do, and we'll hold Iran appropriately accountable, as we have. The last 3 years, more than 500 sanctions against Iran and their destabilizing activities.
Yeah, Iran really has felt the sting of the destabilizing, of punishment for their destabilizing activities. I mean, that is just bull jive. So why would Israel and Bibi, I mean, I know why, because of the military aid, but listen, in terms of strategic advice to an administration that has put them in this position. I mean, there's intelligence failures on the Israelis' part, too, obviously, with respect to October 7th. But everything since, the middling rhetoric, if not outright hostile rhetoric in the direction of Israel, including from leading lights of the left like Elizabeth Warren, who are accusing Bibi and the Israelis of genocide. Well, that'll be muted for a few days now, won't it? For more on all of this, to help us unpack it, please be joined by Stephen Bucci, served America for 3 decades as an Army Special Forces officer and top Pentagon official. He is a visiting fellow in the Heritage Foundation's Allison Center for Foreign Policy Studies now. All right, Stephen Bucci, what do you think of the response and what do you think of the prospect of to my question, if Iran is indeed weaker, as these experts are saying, well, now would be the time to make them even weaker still, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah, that's one way to look at it. The key point, though, is not what you and I think about it. It's what do the Israelis think about it? And, you know, the Israelis need to make the decision as to what's in the best interest for them and for their people. Is it to hit Iran now that they've shown the stuff they have is pretty weak sauce and go for it? Or is it to play it cool, wait a little while, maybe hit them in a different way at, you know, a week or two down the road? I don't know the right answer to that. To be honest with you, though, the right answer is not listen to Joe Biden, because it does not have Israel's best interests at heart. That is pretty clear. He has his best political interests at heart, he thinks, by supporting the folks who are vilifying Israel because he's worried about getting a few more votes in Michigan and a few other places in the country. And Blinken has showed himself to be, at best, a tepid supporter of Israel, and at worst, someone who's himself and his minions are taking active steps to hurt Israel's security position. And you know, the admiral there, you know, he swings like the wind. Sometimes he says stuff that makes sense, and the next minute, you know, literally in the same announcement, as you pointed out, he's talking nonsense. So right now, I don't know if it's the right thing to hit him back immediately, but it's darn sure not put handcuffs on Israel and tell them they can't hit back. And if they do, we'll take some action against them or won't support them. That's just wrong.
Well, maybe now's the time, if not to do something formal in the direction of Iraq, maybe publicly remind the Biden administration, if Republicans are recalcitrant, to that, you know, if you could stop providing cash to the mullahs in Tehran, that would be helpful, too. Then we wouldn't have to retaliate. You know, if you'd stop financing them, we'd appreciate that. Number one. And then number two, turn their attention back to Rafah and the task at hand of doing their best to pull Hamas out of the region, root and branch.
That I agree with you 110%. We should right now stop sending a dime to Iran, and if we can get control over any of the money that we've already transferred to them, I doubt we can, but if we can pull that back, they should pay a price for what they did. This was not even a proportional response for what happened with the killing of those generals. And, you know, the Iranians are masterful negotiators. Now, I agree with General McKenzie that this was not a deliberately low-ball response. You know, they sent things that took a long time to get there. All the people that are trying to twist the facts into pretzels to make it seem like Iran is being reasonable here are wrong. General McKenzie's analysis, I think, is spot on. They threw what they thought was going to be a knockout punch at Israel.
Right.
And it didn't work. The Israelis, with the help of us and some of our other partners, knocked it out of the sky, literally, and protected their country. And now the mullahs are going, oh, you know, crud. Didn't work.
Right. Since they failed miserably, do you think they're going to strike again sometime soon, like within the next 24 hours?
They just called it a tie. The Iranians just said, oh, it's a tie. All right. You know, we retaliated for what you did in Damascus, so let's call it a tie. So if they're trying to call it a tie, I mean, that's what I'm saying is per the general, that he's right that they're weaker, and that's a sign that they're weaker. And this is my point to say, well, maybe there's things that can be done in a subterranean way to weaken them still, even as you're publicly refocusing on Hamas.
Yeah, absolutely. That is a good potential option for them. It's not a slam dunk that that's the way Israel will choose to go. But again, the point is that this is an Israeli decision, not an American Joe Biden decision, who somehow thinks Israel is suddenly our colony, has got to do exactly what we say. That's not what you do with partners. And when partners don't agree with you, you know, you don't automatically cut them loose and say, we're not going to help you in any way, shape, or form. That's being a backstabber, not being a partner. And that's what we're seeing with the Biden administration. This is their true attitude towards Israel. Let Israel hang out there. They breathed a sigh of relief that, you know, Israel has not launched nukes at Iran yet, but now they're trying to get them to back down completely. But I agree with you. Rafah, That operation should be kicked off pretty much immediately. The other proxies around the region, if Israel can hit them and hit them hard, I would do it. And I would deliberately target as many IRGC Quds Force advisors with those proxies as they can get. Not just the generals, but the folks down there showing them how to do things, working their intelligence. If they know the installations where those folks are operating, smack them hard right now.
I want to get your reaction to something else, turning our attention to Ukraine, because apparently Speaker Johnson is going to move an aid package this week that would both be to Israel and Ukraine's benefit. He may have some problems in the House on the Ukraine piece, but nonetheless, that's what's being telegraphed. Here's a J.D. Vance over the weekend, senator from Ohio, of course, talking to Tapper and explaining his opposition to more aid to Ukraine. I wanted to get your reaction. Take a listen.
No, look, my solution to the problem is to rebuild our own country. The reason that we're in this position, Jake, is because we're stretched way too thin. We're stretched way too thin. And the number of weapon systems that we need, the Ukraine needs, that Taiwan needs, that Israel needs, and we can't do all of these things at once. So when you're stretched too thin, you've got to focus and you've got to rebuild your own country. Let's take just one of those weapon systems that we're talking about, 155-millimeter artillery shells. The Russians currently have a 5-to-1 advantage over the Ukrainians. The Israelis will need this stuff. The Taiwanese need this stuff. And, of course, America needs this stuff. Can we possibly fight all of those conflicts at once? No, the math just doesn't make sense. So what we should be doing is with Ukraine, encouraging them to take a defensive posture, not these disastrous counteroffensive the Biden administration has been promoting.
The counteroffensive is within Ukraine, though. The counteroffensive is within Ukraine. They're not seeking
land from Russia. And in fact, just
I'm not passing judgment on the morality of what they're doing. Of course, it's their territory, Jake, but you have to acknowledge military reality on the ground. If they're going to waste a ton of money, a ton of lives, and a ton of ammunition on a counteroffensive strategy, but a defensive strategy might actually work, we've got to choose the strategy that might actually work.
Stephen?
I would respectfully disagree with the senator. I think we should be supporting Ukraine. I think his view of the effect of allowing Putin just to keep what he's got now is he's lowballing. He does not understand the effect that's going to have on a mind like Putin's 6 months down the road, a year down the road, when he says, okay, they let us keep what we had. We got the rest. We got the recoup. And now we're going to go for the next round. I think that is far more likely than if we say, okay, Vlad, you can keep what you got. Let's just be nice. That is the exact same thought process that Neville Chamberlain had. And he thought, oh, we just give them, the Sudetenland. We give them a little bit of Czechoslovakia. It'll be fine. That's all he really wants. And I don't think J.D. Vance thinks he's a Neville Chamberlain-type personality. But he needs to understand he is using exactly the same logic there. I think we could upgrade our production of certain systems. 155 rounds would be a good one to do right now. I'm not sure the Biden administration is ready to do that. But, you know, we are going to get in a tight spot here. And we need to probably upgun that production right now.
Stephen Bucci served America for 3 decades as an Army Special Forces officer and top Pentagon official. He is a visiting fellow in the Heritage Foundation's Allison Center for Foreign Policy Studies at present. Stephen, thank you as always. Appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I want to go back to this this guy, Rizvi. He is the member of the Chicago Anti-War Committee that was doing a train-the-trainer exercise at Chicago Teamsters HQ over the weekend in advance of the DNC and other nefarious, hysterical, shrill protests or worse that may be planned by these individuals. This is teaching those in attendance, fully N95'd up, of course.
Right.
To say say in Farsi, "Death to America, death to Israel." So they're on key when they take it to college campuses, to Lakeshore Drive, to your local Starbucks.
So I'm going to teach you a chant in Persian that you can use if you ever encounter those Zionist freaks, whether they be Iranian or whatever. All right. Now I don't drink margaritas, but we all know what a margarita is. We all know what a bar is. So you're going to say, Marg bar.
Marg bar.
Marg bar Israel.
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 Thank you.
What does that mean? What does it mean? What am I chanting? What am I
doing? Oh, so it has two meanings, depending on the answer. It can mean death to or down with. So
can we get a Marg Bar America?
We can get a Marg Bar America. Yes, we can. Marg Bar America!
Marg Bar America!
Marg Bar America!
Marg Bar America!
Thank you.
It's important for a number of counts. I mean, first and foremost, that you have this, mob mentality with such enthusiasm for anti-Semitism as well as hatred of America. Mm-hmm. Secondly, that you have people that if you talk to the rank and file, not of those apparatchiks, but of the Teamsters, they would probably to a man and woman, distanced themselves from that training session that took place at their dues-financed headquarters. And so, you know, how do you get rank-and-file Teamsters and other members of the trades? Forget the public sector unions, teachers, AFSCME, SEIU, they're lost. The trades, you know, which Teamsters is sort of kind of trade, it's a little bit different. They need to be reached on this, too, and they need to see what their resources are being put to. Because I don't think hatred of America or hatred of Jews is something that most Teamsters are signed up for.
Well, why would they even let them? It's like letting the fox into the hen house. Why would they even do it?
Because of who's in charge of those unions these days.
Okay. Got a lot of text messages saying, what union, what locals was this? Where did it take place?
I assume, I don't know. It was just reported by the Free Press, Barry Weiss's outfit, that it was a Teamsters HQ in Chicago. I don't know if that was like Joint Council 25 headquarters or where exactly, but probably if it was Chicago proper.
Call your union rep and just ask him where was this taking place.
Yeah, well,
and stress
exactly.
your if you're upset about it. I mean, text into the show. That's great, but do something about it. Get mad as hell and call somebody. Call your union rep. Call the Teamsters headquarters and just say, you know, like, you, this is not what we stand for. I don't want my dues going to this. And what the hell's going on?
I'm sure a BA would be able to get to a bottom of it if a Teamsters BA was properly motivated. For more on this and other matters, law and order, we're pleased to be joined by Professor William Jacobson, clinical professor of law and director of the Securities Law Clinic at Cornell. He's also the founder of LegalInsurrection.com and president of the Legal Insurrection Foundation and the Equal Protection Project, too. Professor Jacobson, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Great to be on.
I saw over at your site, LegalInsurrection.com, that you attended and spoke at a Cornell Unity rally. And I wonder if this is a rally where, you know, American flag with the Israeli flag on stage and so forth. And just reading the account of it seemed to be like rallying, like singing and being positive. Death to Palestinians type of chanting going on at that rally?
No, not at all. And I think you've hit the nail on the head. That's the difference between the pro-Israel protesters and the quote-unquote pro-Palestine protesters. Is we were chanting for peace. We were urging reconciliation. We were acknowledging the rights of the Jewish people in the ancestral homeland of the Jews, and we were calling for unity in this country. This was a unity rally, not just for Jews, not just for Israel, but for the United States as well. Whereas when you go to the quote-unquote pro-Palestinian rallies, they're chanting for death. They want violence. They want intifadas. They want to ethnically cleanse Israel from the river to the sea. And I think that the clips you were just playing and what you were talking about is a very good example of what I've been warning about for years, is that the anti-Israel protesters are also the anti-American protesters. There's a reason why they're teaching people to chant the Iranian mullah phrase, death to America, death to Israel. This is a really dangerous movement in this country, and people need to wake up to it.
Just a point of order. We got a text that Teamsters headquarters.
Oh, yes.
It's a local 786 on South Ashland. The president, Eddie Rizzo. So maybe some Teamsters would want to direct their inquiries to the top there.
Right.
President Rizzo.
Don't have practice sessions again there at that location.
Well, or they can, and you can, I guess, explain your position. But it's always good to put people in the position of having to explain themselves, because then we understand where everybody stands, don't we now? Professor Jacobson, so what do you sense is the temperature on college campuses? You know, your own, the Ivy League, probably you're closest to. After the October 7th terrorist attack, and then there was the beginnings of the Israeli response, and that generated the give the pushback from the Students for Free Palestine and these other campus groups. And now you've got Democrat politicians like Elizabeth Warren saying that Israel is guilty of genocide. So I just but then you have unity rallies like you were had on Cornell. So I'm just trying to get a sense of what you think the status of things are on college campuses was sort of the incubator of some of this silliness.
Well, certainly on the surface, it's extremely hostile that the movements are anti-Israel. They want the destruction of Israel. So the voices on campus, the loudest voices, are clearly extremely hostile. I don't think that necessarily represents a majority opinion, but, you know, it only takes 10% of a campus to be activated and 10% of a campus to, you know, chant these things, and it seems like a lot of people. So I think there is a real problem, but I think the superficial problem may be worse. Now, that superficial problem is a problem. I mean, at Cornell, we've got these students marching through libraries and through classroom areas with bullhorns disrupting people, and the administration has struggled to deal with it. I think the administration here should deal with it the way a couple of other schools have recently, which is if you're going to violate our rules, you're going to get written up. And if you do it blatantly and you do it after you were asked to stop and you keep doing it, we're going to suspend you. I think that, you know, enforcing the rules equally to all people is the answer to this. And at Cornell, you're not allowed to march through a classroom area with bullhorns because people are entitled to teach and people are entitled to study. So I think, you know, I think that superficially it's extremely bad. I don't know to what extent it reflects the underlying student sentiment.
I wanted to get your reaction to what happened over the weekend in Memphis, Tennessee, where a police officer was murdered. Two other officers were injured by a suspect that had been released just a month earlier by the local prosecutor, a Soros-funded prosecutor, who eliminated cash bail because it's marginalizes minority communities, he said, a story we've heard before. And so this guy, despite having an arsenal, what the left would normally call weapons of war, possessing these weapons illegally, being in a stolen car, was released on his own recognizance last month. Now he opens fire on police and he kills a police officer just the last weekend on Friday morning. So, you know, I remember during the defund the police move, the height of it, you had some black residents of Minneapolis sue, saying basically an equal protection claim, saying they were not, but local, but sort of a quasi equal protection claim, but at the local level, that there's this guarantee in the Minneapolis St. Paul charter that equal police resources for every neighborhood. And these black residents of a majority black neighborhood saying, we're not getting equal police resources and we want them because we want to be protected from the criminal element. And they won. And I wonder if there is, additional plays on that order or plays of a similar nature for residents to make who are being terrorized by the criminal element who is being facilitated by, shockingly but true, their local justice system.
Yeah, well, I think that's a problem. The, you know, post-George Floyd has cost, you know, defund the police movement, Black Lives Matter movement, has cost hundreds of people their lives. And most of those hundreds of people are in the black communities and policemen. And so it really, they have unleashed a reign of terror on our society, but they call it, you know, prison reform, or they call it justice reform. But everybody knew at the time that's not what it was. And so we have these terrible situations. And I think people need to elect better prosecutors and need to change the laws. There's no reason why somebody should be, these people should be released without bail, without any conditions, should be allowed, you know, to roam around society free when they've been charged with these serious offenses.
Keep doing it over and over. I mean, they know it's not working. They know people are dying because of the consequences of their actions. Do you think they're just not reversing it because they don't want to admit that they made a mistake?
I think the people behind that movement are so ideologically addicted mm-hmm. to tearing down our system that they are not going to give up any part of their effort. So I think it's purely ideological. I don't think they care. I think they view our entire system as irredeemably corrupt and irredeemably racist, and anything they can do to puncture that system and try to tear us down, they'll do. I mean, I've seen these people for a long time, and I've been on your show many times talking about them. They are really hardcore ideologues. These are the equivalent. They may not profess communist ideology, but whatever their ideology is, they are true believers. They really hate our system, and they don't care. I really think these activists do not care that police are getting shot by people released.
No, I mean, we had the clip this morning, Cornel West, Ivy League professor. He announced his VP candidate, Malina Abdullah, former head of Pan-African Studies at California State University. And she is the co-founder of BLM, Black Lives Matter LA. And her position is that, historically, police were slave catchers, and they continue to be slave catchers into the 21st century. So it's pretty clear ideological stance that she's taken and the implications of said stance, which is to defund police, which is where she is. So, I mean, it's not like they're couching their views. And so my question is, particularly with like the concept of your Equal Protection Project, is there areas of the law where people should look for the possibility of novel causes of action to demand police protection or criminal justice, the upholding of criminal statutes where they're being willfully ignored by prosecutors and judges, for example?
I don't think there's a civil lawsuit answer to it.
Okay.
Prosecutors have broad discretion, and judges who release these people have basically absolute immunity for the actions
right.
they take as judges. So the answer here is political. People need to stop electing what in many cases are these Soros-backed prosecutors. That's the answer. And if your local Democratic Party is putting these people in place and running these people for office, then maybe you need to vote against them. Because let's face it, this is a Democrat Party problem. This is not a Republican Party problem.
Yeah, I just wanted to get clarity. Just to drive the point home, it's a political problem that requires a political solution at the ballot box. Professor William Jacobson, clinical professor of law, director of the Securities Law Clinic at Cornell, founder of LegalInsurrection.com, and president of the Legal Insurrection Foundation. Professor Jacobson, thank you as always. Appreciate it.
Great, thank you.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We used to have Tax Freedom Day in this country that was, more celebrated. It didn't Tax Foundation, Americans for Tax Reform, Grover Norquist Group, Cato Institute. It's sort of become mooted over the years a bit, hasn't it? But, I mean, the bottom line is we work for, and especially in Illinois, you work for about the first 5 months of the year, well, first 4 to 4.5 months of the year, for the government, just straight right. on state and federal income taxes. And then if you layer in regulation and the costs associated with that, then you get into midsummer in terms of your indentured servitude to federal and, in some cases, like in Illinois, state government. And the concept of tax reform, I know, of course, we had the Trump tax cuts and the SALT issue, state and local tax deductions, that issue. But I mean, in terms of rethinking what we tax altogether, starting with first principles, you tax something, you get less of it. So do you want less work? Because that's what the income tax is. It's a tax on work. Do you want more work? Do you want more productivity? Do you want less productivity? It seems like an obvious question, which speaks to how strange it is that we tax work. You want more of that, but yet we tax it, and you get less of it, which is why Albert Einstein famously said the most difficult thing in the world to understand is the income tax. So there has been this proposal for a fair tax out there for some time, and maybe now is the time to revisit it. Well, certainly in a presidential election year, with things like the House and Senate hanging in the balance, now is a time for big, bold ideas, isn't it? Well, maybe. We'll see. Stephen Hayes is chairman and president of Fairtax.org. Chad Hagen is the founder of Hagen Capital Group and a member of the board of advisors at Fairtax.org. And both of those gentlemen join us now. Stephen and Chad, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Bob, it's our pleasure. Thank you for having us.
Oh, this is Dan, but that's
my name's
okay.
Amy,
but... Bob,
oh, Dan,
enough.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. Bob, Dan, I've been called worse. So the fair tax, it's an idea that's been around for a while, is, to paraphrase Victor Hugo, is it an idea whose time has finally come?
Well, it's an idea, its time is past due. But whether or not you can get through the bureaucracy and the elites who rely on the income tax to control people and the members of Congress to raise money, that's been our biggest issue all along. Nobody argues the points that you made in your opening, that it is a much better system. It's a system that rewards people who work. It's a system who rewards people who save. It's a system that rewards American producers and doesn't reward importers like our present system does. Economically, there's really not an argument which is better. It just comes down to the fact that many people have become so wedded to the present system for those reasons, control and money, that it's very difficult to move them. And that's why it takes people like all of us on the phone and all your listeners to start making pressure, because the one thing that they have to have is to be reelected. And that's where we really have the ability to force a change.
Part of the problem is, just so we're talking here specifics, the fair tax is 23% national sales tax.
Yes.
And so, part of that, of course, is the sticker shock when somebody says, oh, my gosh, a 23% national sales tax. 23% sales tax. Oh, my gosh, I'm going to get crushed when I go to the grocery store and at the gas pump and so on and so forth. And it's just difficult. I think the challenge is always helping people connect the dots to say, well, if we scrap the income tax system and we went to this, the net is going to be tax savings for you.
And that's very true, because what is left out in most of the criticism is the fact that you get your whole paycheck. You do not have withholding of payroll taxes or income taxes, so you get all your money, and you go out and you make your own decisions what to buy. The second thing that's left out is that people will receive a family allowance, we call it a prebate, the first of every month, to cover the spending they would do up to the poverty level. So a family making $40,000 to four would make the first $40,000 of purchases of new, underlying the word new, goods and services and retail services without any fair tax being paid. And contrast that with the present system, where everyone's going to pay on that $40,000 the payroll tax. So you get more money in their hands, and you give them the choice of how much tax they pay.
Well, don't you think that'd be a hard sell for states that don't have a statewide sales tax, like Alaska, Delaware, Montana, New Hampshire, Oregon?
I think it's a hard sell for bureaucrats, but it's not a hard sell for the states that are looking at this objectively. For example, Georgia, mm-hmm. where Chad is from, is working very hard to eliminate the income tax and go to a version of the fair tax at the state level, because they want to be able to not punish lower income people while giving much more growth potential to the state. So I think that's really what a lot of states are looking at, because they're trying to lower property taxes, like in Nebraska, and in Texas they're trying to find other ways of doing funding. And as I said, Chad's been very active in this, and I think we're going to see this spreading across other states as well.
Well, in Illinois, we're increasing all of the taxes, sales tax, gas tax, property taxes, trying to increase the income tax. So, I mean, there are some states that go in completely opposite direction, too. But, of course, those are the the failed states. So in the states or with members of Congress that are receptive to this, some of probably the libertarian oriented members of Congress, maybe a Rand Paul or a Thomas Massey or a Mike Lee or something. So, what are the stumbling blocks for them that are supportive, those legislators that are supportive, state or federal, that such that they don't carry water for this? They're not more vociferous about this. They don't want to make this a centerpiece of their policy agenda.
Because it gets so attacked when they take that position, particularly in election year, that it takes up so much of the air to try to defend it and explain it, that a lot of these people are waiting and hoping for a president to pick up and carry the banner. And I think that's really what it's going to take, is someone who has that ability to get airtime and who's willing to get out in front on it and start broadcasting it. And then you're going to find many of these people who've been quiet, even though they openly support getting rid of the income tax. I mean, you got a choice. And you brought it up very eloquently. Do you want the IRS, and do you want to have to file income tax returns? Are you really going to defend that system that hurts America? Or are you going to look at options that would actually help all of us and give us control again of how much federal tax we pay?
Well, and it's also such an egalitarian argument, right, for those that want to play class envy politics on the left. I mean, this eliminates the need for so many tax shelters and tax attorneys for the people that are wealthy enough to afford them, and accountants and waiting in queue at H&R Block and all the. So, I mean, it's also like simplifying your life in addition to reducing your tax burden for productive people. I mean, it broadens. Obviously, every adult in America is going to pay taxes because you're paying the sales tax. So it's more egalitarian in that sense. It's easier, and it doesn't advantage the system to the wealthy who are able to manipulate the Rube Goldberg-like tax laws to their benefit.
Absolutely. And Chad, I think, can comment on that because he very much is handling investments and works with a lot of these people that are plagued with the system. Chad, do you want to comment?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you recall Leona Helmsley from Manhattan, but she had that famous comment that said only the little people pay taxes.
Right.
The super wealthy do not pay their fair share of taxes. And as far as the consumption tax goes, the federal government already has a form of consumption tax on a few situations in the form of a federal excise tax, and that's on gas, airline tickets, alcohol, and cigarettes.
Right. I mean, so it strikes me the fair tax is very much suffers from the infirmities of the politics surrounding Social Security reform and putting it as an option for private retirement accounts. Remember how that got blown up under George W. Bush, even just the prospect of having a discussion about it, because people, I don't know. I mean, the politicians are so good at scaring people about having more autonomy. It's like, oh my God, me in charge of my own things. Yeah, I have a 401k, I have a trading account, but no, not my Social Security. I can't be put in charge of that. Let's leave that to the politicians. I mean, it's so strange, but I don't know. They've been able to psychologically manipulate the electorate effectively.
Well, Dan, they have.
Absolutely.
But this
income tax is so confusing as is. It's so confusing for a lot of people as is that they've been manipulated to think, oh no, we can't have any more reform because that'll just tax us more. And a lot of the powers that we're fighting in D.C. are so ingrained in the income tax system as is, it's heavily weaponized. And so that's a lot of the uphill battle that we face, is kind of fighting those systems that are already in place to replace them with a consumption tax.
Yeah, you'd almost have to have a constitutional amendment prohibiting an income tax, because, I mean, I would be concerned, too. Sure, we're going to get a 23% national sales tax, and then here come the politicians back to reimpose the income tax after they've made this deal. You know, you get temporary tax relief here, and the permanent spending is going to necessitate new and exciting taxes down the road.
Well, and that's true. But one thing, back to your point on Social Security, if you went to the fair tax, you would have taken away the funding problems for Social Security, because instead of relying on a very much decreasing number of workers per retiree, you're spreading it all across the country. Everybody is a consumer. Everybody is contributing to the Social Security payments. So you suddenly make Social Security and Medicare solvent going forward. And that is a huge point that I think is going to come when people start looking at the idea that in 10 years, they may see a 10, 15, 20% decrease in Social Security benefits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's too simple. It has too many attributes for it to be contemplated by the political ruling class. Yes, exactly. We will adopt this as a last resort only. Stephen Hayes, chairman and president of Fairtax.org. Chad Hagen, founder of Hagen Capital Group and member of the board of advisors at Fairtax.org. Thank you for joining us, gentlemen. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan and Amy.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, and they both joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Andrea Kirsten is the head of COPA, civilian oversight body when it comes to police. And she's taken full advantage of her little star turn with the national attention being paid to the fallout from the Dexter Reed police-involved shooting after the body cam videos from police officers involved were released last week. She was on CNN over the weekend explaining what COPA is doing. It's very interesting, since COPA seemed to have drawn an immediate conclusion about the police when the memo was made public that called for them to be stripped of their police power, something that we talked with former top assistant Cook County State's Attorney Bob Mylan about last week, and he said that was wholly inappropriate. Here's Andrea Kirsten on CNN.
All I can really assure the public is that, again, the totality of the circumstances, including officers' actions and Dexter Reed's actions that led to this use of deadly force and led to this fatal shooting and an officer being shot, are all of what we will be examining as our investigation continues.
Yeah.
I don't like that she was on CNN. She should just be quiet and conduct the investigation, don't you think?
Well, but now we're reserving judgment, we're conducting this investigation, but you already led with strip them of their police powers.
Right.
Something else, too, that's, of course, the Chicago Press Corps is doing the bidding of the, their fellow travelers who are anti-police. You saw the story perhaps over the weekend in the NPR Times. The five Chicago police officers involved in the fatal shooting of Dexter Reed have been investigated a combined 41 times since 2019. These are citizen complaints, with many of those complaints stemming from traffic stops. Right. People don't like being pulled over, and they say, oh, I was mistreated or what have you. The idea of complaints against police officers and tactical officers in this case that have the sort of interaction that they have, particularly in a climate where you're so encouraged to make accusations in the direction of police, and you can do so anonymously, 41 times over 5 years spread across five officers doesn't impress me much. I'd like to hear a lot of the particulars and any sort of adjudication to the negative before we place too much weight on that. But this is the sort of insinuation of guilt that the press corps is accustomed to do when it comes to police.
Yeah, Black Club Chicago did the same thing, you know, under the Freedom of Information Act. They got all this information with officers, and they're trying to vilify them as if, you know, the people normally complain when people make a traffic stop. They have a right to do so. So also, Mayor Johnson, he's trying to be copacetic, I think, to both sides.
As mayor and as a father raising a family, including two black boys on the west side of Chicago. I am personally devastated to see yet another young black man lose his life during an interaction with the police. My heart breaks for the family of Dexter Reed.
But he didn't mention that the black man tried to kill police by shooting 11 rounds at them.
Yeah, but he did the day after the videos were released when he said, oh, and also there was an officer shot and he was black too. And if the bullet had been a few inches in a different direction, he could have been killed. I mean, he's trying to middle the issue, but his real disposition, I mean, I think is pretty obvious. It has been since he was a professional organizer with CTU and really as a candidate until he sort of had to reposition himself a little bit, where I never said I'm for defunding police. I said that's a position that's out there. Yeah.
That's
nice pivot. So, I mean, you know where he's coming from. Everybody knows where he's coming from, and everybody knows that the antagonism towards police, particularly layered in with racial politics, still sells, unfortunately. We can't get past the racial politics just to talk about people obeying the law or not obeying the law. As our friend Charles Thomas is wont to say, this is about people who obey the law and criminals. People who obey the law and criminals. It's real simple if you make it just about everybody following the rules and being respectful of one another. And if somebody isn't, then that person needs to be held to account regardless of their race. But we can't make it that simple in Chicago, can we now? For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by former Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson. Eddie Johnson, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Hi, Dan and Amy. Thanks for having me this morning.
So, you know, what's your reaction to what you've seen transpire over the last week since those body cam videos were released?
You know, let me say this. You know, I had to deal with these same issues when I was superintendent. And I think what people are missing with this particular situation, because I've had a lot of people ask me, you know, how does a guy get killed for not wearing a seatbelt? Well, the truth of it is, he didn't get killed for not wearing a seatbelt. He got killed because he fired at the police and actually shot one of them. You know, so that needs to be said right up front. The circumstances regarding the traffic stop, you know, who knows how that actually went down? That's why you have an investigation. But I tell you what I don't like is people commenting on it, because the integrity of the investigation is critical. And you don't want to sway it either way at this point. And that's why the superintendent won't comment on him, and I don't blame him. And to be totally honest, COPA shouldn't be, you know, chiming in on it. You know, they released what they released, and that should be the end of it. They should not be talking about the investigation while it's ongoing, because what happens is that tends to sway opinion about it. And as we know in Chicago, we have a lot of opinion out there, and it typically falls along racial lines, unfortunately. You know, and that's sad, because at the end of the day, this is a tragic event. It was. There was some loss of life, you know, with an interaction with the police. And trust me when I tell you, you know, you feel bad for the family because they still loved him, and we get that. But you also have to understand those five police officers have to deal with this the rest of their lives also, you know. And trust me when I tell you, they didn't come to work that morning thinking, you know, they were going to get into a shooting with someone, fire 96 rounds, and someone lose their life. But here's the bottom line. If you fire and shoot at the police, rest assured, they're going to shoot back, and they're going to continue shooting until they reasonably think the threat is neutralized. And it's easy, you know, after these incidents to sit back and look at the video and say what we think about it. But while you're in that situation, there's a lot of stress involved in that. And I, you know, I've been in shootings myself, and it's not fun, you know, so I just don't like the commentary about it at this point while the investigation is going
on.
Well,
do you think COPA should have sent that letter to Superintendent Snelling where COPA seems to be focused on that one tactical officer who they said fired more than a dozen shots, and including the three final shots as Reed laid motionless on the ground?
Well, I think, you know, that's pretty standard when you have police-involved shootings. You know, I got those letters all the time also. And, you know, I never made a decision on things like that. It had to be really egregious for me to relieve police officers prior to the investigation being complete. Now, sometimes you might. You know, so I don't have a big issue with them actually sending the letter. But I think at this point, they shouldn't be commenting on whether or not they shouldn't be commenting publicly on whether or not those officers should be relieved of their police powers. They sent the letter, and let's leave it at that.
Wouldn't you like, I mean, I understand what you were saying, too, and we've said the same thing about families grieving and the family, in this case, the Reed family grieving, and you want to give them wide berth to grieve however they need to grieve because they lost a loved one, even if he was flawed and he did some things wrong. But, I mean, in this moment, wouldn't you just want once like to hear somebody say, it's terrible what happened to my son, and I don't wish this on anybody else. And one of the things that we have to recognize is that whatever the police did, my son was wrong to, in this case, open fire on police. And I hope to, you know, message to other young people out there, whatever happens on the street, this is why we have courts of law. My son was wrong. Maybe he shouldn't have been pulled over. That investigation will determine that. But he was wrong to open fire on police. Don't do that. Don't waste your life.
You know what, Dan? I was having a conversation yesterday about that exact thing. And, yeah, it would be nice. You know, I understand people are grieving, you know, because they lost a loved one. And I also understand, you know, the financial ramifications with something like this. But the bottom line is this. You know, I tell young folks, especially young black guys, if the police stop you and you think you're violated, then your remedy and relief is filing a complaint or filing a lawsuit, and you get your remedy through court. But you don't have the right to just defy them and not comply. If, let's face it, and I hate to put it this bluntly, but it's the truth. Had we had compliance in this incident as well as some of the other ones, we wouldn't even be talking about it. You know, and the fact that he fired first at the police, you know, let's not skirt that issue. That's what ultimately caused this shootout, not the seatbelt. You know, so it is a little aggravating for, you know, police, law enforcement in general when this type of thing happens. But, you know, you're very rarely going to see a situation where people actually admit that the things that you just discussed. It would be refreshing to see that, but I understand that side of it also. However, you know, like you said, it would be nice to hear that.
Well, and until and unless somebody can say that, I mean, other than police or politicians or radio talk shows, until some people in the neighborhoods that are afflicted with endemic violent crime can say that, then you're going to see more of it. We saw it happen in back of the yards over the weekend, too, with that mass shooting that took the life of an 11-year-old girl. Until you want to talk about the people that are gaming the system, the people that are engendering the endemic violence, and say when something bad happens to somebody who has been on the wrong side of the law, and Dexter Reed was before March 21st, a couple times at least, we know. Not to mention whatever family altercation occurred where he was shot by a family member. We don't have the details on. That's a little curious. But until some people are challenge members of the community, the so-called representatives of the community, whether they're men of the cloth or just sort of community activists, and they show up to be interviewed at every crime scene, until that happens, then you have you're just going to see more of it because you're excusing inexcusable behavior, and there's just not moral clarity on this issue.
Yeah, you're hitting it right on the head. I agree. You know, we tend to not want to hold people accountable. You know, you want to hold the police accountable for everything they do, but the general public doesn't want to be held accountable. So until that occurs, you're right. They just exacerbate the problem and encourage other people to. And I'm not saying particularly this situation, but I'm just talking about overall. That's why we have a repeat of people filing frivolous lawsuits against the police, because it's an easy way to make money at this point. And we all see that all over the country. So, you know, when we get to that point, then I think we can lower some of this, the things that are going on right now. I think we can drive it down a bit.
All right, Superintendent Johnson, of course, we have the DNC coming here in August. And what are you hearing? What kind of training police are going through now to be prepared for that event?
Well, they are going through training. But just talking to police officers, you know, out there in the field, they want more training than they say they're getting right now. Now, I don't personally have any knowledge of what they're actually doing, but I've heard several of them complaining that they don't think they're going to be ready. And let's hope that that's not the case. I know the superintendent is doing everything he can. And one of the faults, I think, of leadership, you have to have the political will to back your police and give them the proper training and resources that they need. And that's why Rahm Emanuel and I were such good partners, because I tell you, he never wavered on, you know, getting the equipment and resources that we needed. So hopefully they'll be ready. I know that they are, you know, going down a path where they're getting these officers trained up. But, you know, at that time we had 13,500. I think there's about 11,500 now. So that's still a large amount of people to cycle through training. So let's just hope that they get it done.
Well, yeah, and that was before the defund police movement reached its apex. And even though it's subsided somewhat, I mean, we have no car chases, then it went to no foot chases. Now we're questioning traffic stops. Now some people, like Sheila Betty of Northwestern Law, are questioning the existence of tactical units themselves. She referred to them, and I can't say this enough, as hunters, and Dexter Reed was their prey. So in that environment, and you know, I know you don't want to get involved in the politics of it, but you can't avoid it, given it's the Democrat National Committee, given that these professional agitators are all of the leftist variety, I don't know how it ends well if there's any sort of disruption, which seems to be in the planning stages right now from what we've seen at Teamsters halls around town and so forth.
Yeah, you know, listen, I've heard the rhetoric about tactical teams. Here's the situation. You know, the uniform officers out there in patrol in the districts are really tied to that radio. So you do need a group of officers that can respond, you know, independently of the radio. I think it's an easy point your finger type deal for a lot of people far to the left. But the reality of it is, in a big city like Chicago, you need tactical officers. You know, you just can't operate in a city like this if all you have is uniform officers out there handling, going racing from call to call. It just doesn't work like that. And I know, you know, a lot of people don't understand that, but that's just the reality of it. And then we have to understand, too, you know, you got tactical teams in all the districts as well as some units. We hear about these things every so often. You know, we have thousands of encounters every day in the city of Chicago with police officers. And you don't hear about a lot of negative things, such as what happened with the incident with Dexter Reed. You know, so when you look at it in those terms, yeah, you're going to have some things, because believe me, Dan and Amy, policing is not easy. You know, so sometimes you're going to have situations. Now, one thing that I liked about the consent decree is it was supposed to, and it was while I was there, but it's supposed to ensure that the Chicago Police Department gets the money, the resources, the training, and the equipment that they need to bring them into the 21st century. And from what I'm hearing right now, it's lagging behind. But that's one of the things that would help make the police department better. You know, so the training, the money that you have to invest in them, you have to do that if you want them to be the best. If you want them to be the best, you got to treat them like the best. And it's as simple as that.
Eddie Johnson, former Chicago Police Superintendent. Of course, Eddie, thank you as always for joining us. Appreciate your time.
Not a problem. You guys have a great day.
Well, you too. Thank you so much. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.